You're listening to SBS News.
The new Commissioner of the Australian Federal Police says her leadership will be characterised by a focus on social cohesion. Chrissy Barrett, the first woman to lead the AFP, has amended the agency's mission statement to include defend and protect Australia from domestic and global security threats. In a wide-ranging interview with SBS's Sarah Tomevska, Commissioner Barrett says the agency will have a laser focus on disrupting crimes that impact Australia's sovereignty, democracy and social cohesion.
Commissioner, thanks for speaking with SBS. You're the first woman to lead the Australian Federal Police. Congratulations. What will your priorities be in this role?
Thank you. So under my leadership, the AFP will have a laser focus on disrupting crimes that impact our sovereignty, our democracy, our social cohesion, our financial systems, our future prosperity. And I want to be really clear when I talk about our future prosperity. What I'm talking about there is, you know, our youth cohort as well, the future of our country. One of my five priorities as the commissioner will be very focused on protecting vulnerable communities. And as part of that, looking at how we ensure that our young people in this country are safe and they're free from radicalisation, they're free from the vulnerabilities associated with child exploitation and other abhorrent crimes like that. So that will be really called out as one of my five key priorities.
What are the biggest threats to social cohesion at present?
So if I take you back to what I just spoke about in terms of being laser focused on crimes that are really jeopardising our social cohesion, our sovereignty, our democracy. We have seen quite a shift in the operating environment over the last couple of years. So post-October 7, 2023, I guess traditionally the AFP's role, if we talk about a national security lens, was traditional terrorism, so I'm thinking religiously motivated violent extremism, and also espionage and foreign interference. What we have seen over the last couple of years is us moving into an environment where we are seeing individuals or groups who are either commenting or undertaking behaviours that are jeopardising how people feel safe in this country. So when I talk about social cohesion, we are seeing groups and individuals who are looking to cause high harm to our social cohesion and are looking to espouse hatred. They're looking to create fear within communities. So the AFP, as a result of that, has now established national security investigations teams, dedicated national security investigations teams. These teams are based in Melbourne, Sydney and Canberra. And they are, as I said, solely focused on individuals or groups who think that they can behave in a way in this country that causes sectors of the community or the community more broadly to feel unsafe or to feel that there's a hatred perpetrated because of race, because of religion, or because of other protected attributes that that they may hold.
I'll get into those teams in a second. I just want to pick up what you said about since October 7, the security environment has shifted. Is that because of domestic elements or is that because of foreign interference or people in other countries stirring up social unrest?
I think it's a combination of both. So certainly we acknowledge that events overseas in the Middle East, in Russia, Ukraine, even in the US, that does reverberate here in Australia. And, you know, I think we've all seen that and how that some of that is playing out literally on our streets and the impact that that is having on some parts of our community and the community more broadly. Another thing we have seen and we have spoken about this, the AFP has spoken about this recently, is what we would describe as the blurring of crime types. So where we are seeing an overlap of traditional organised crime actors, state actors from overseas, taking advantage of what is a volatile environment here in relation to social cohesion and using that to their advantage in terms of...
Can you name those state actors?
So obviously actually the Prime Minister recently named Iran as a state actor, where we have seen information and intelligence that suggests that they were involved and, as I described, utilising organised crime networks in this country to facilitate acts of violence or hatred. So that is one example that we have called out.
Is that something you're seeing more and more of?
It is certainly something that we are focused on. We have very mature and established counter-foreign interference task force here in Australia, and we have had quite a bit of success in terms of investigating and putting matters before the court in relation to espionage and foreign interference. I think what we have seen, as I said, is a shift in the environment where traditionally you would see organised crime keeping to organised crime. You would see state actors using more traditional methods to have an impact on our sovereignty in our country. We are now seeing, as I said, what we describe as an overlap there. We are seeing tasking and payment being, transferred to organised crime networks to use what they already have, the systems and the networks they already have set up in this country. So that is certainly a focus for us and our partner agencies as well.
How concerning is it from a national security perspective to see hundreds of thousands of Australians marching in major cities against multiculturalism?
So first point I would make is, of course, lawful protest is something that, every Australian has a right to, and our states and territory law enforcement counterparts work very, very hard to ensure that lawful protests are occurring in a safe way and minimise the impact on the broader community. So that's the first point I would make. But where that protest activity is leading to criminality or the committing of offences, breaches of legislation, there is absolutely a role for law enforcement. We work very closely with our state and territory law enforcement partners. Often they are the ones on the ground in the moment at the protests. So they have the ability to utilise and access all of the Commonwealth legislation that we have. But through the establishment of these national security investigations teams, it's really us, strongly showing that the AFP has a lead role to play in relation to enforcing legislation around hate crimes, around hate symbols, around any illegal behaviour that really primarily is undertaken to cause fear, to promote hatred within our community.
And just to understand what you're saying about some of those elements in terms of foreign actors, state actors, are they driving the types of protests we have seen in recent times?
So what I would say to that, I'd go back to the point I made earlier. We are very much focused on the intelligence picture and of course, understanding the environment we're operating in, because the better we understand the environment, the better we can disrupt, the better we can target, the more impact we can have in relation to keeping the community safe, whether that is the AFP playing a lead role, whether it's us playing a national coordination role, whether it's us playing a support role to a domestic partner, to an international partner. That is the unique ability of the AFP, and particularly under my leadership, us really deliberately and collaboratively working with domestic and international partners to ensure that we are addressing traditional threats, but also the new and emerging threats that we are seeing play out and threaten our social cohesion and our democracy and sovereignty and the things I've already referred to.
How are the national security investigations teams work in practice?
Yeah, so as I said, new teams, we obviously have been undertaking this type of work for quite a while now, but really prioritising and calling it out through the establishment of these teams that will solely focus on crimes, as I said, that are aimed at causing the fear, the hatred in the community. We have them established in Melbourne, Sydney and Canberra for the moment and looking to expand. But really, those teams will be utilising the full capabilities of the AFP. So we have some really unique, sophisticated capabilities around intelligence, around technology, heavily utilising our partnerships as well, as I said.
So that includes access to Five Eyes intelligence?
Absolutely. So that's a huge, I guess, weapon in our arsenal in terms of having such strong relationships with the Five Eyes through the Five Eyes Law Enforcement Group and other related groups where we can share information, we can share intelligence, we can, share observations and experiences in terms of being able to learn from each other. But also have that force multiplier effect. So, you know, there are scenarios and examples where the AFP may not have the access or the ability to take a particular action, but our partners overseas may, our partners here domestically may. So the way I would describe it is, you know, really leveraging the full suite of capabilities across our partners and our agency to have the best strategic effect in keeping the community safe.
What is the rationale for people who do seek to disrupt social cohesion in Australia? What are they trying to achieve?
I wouldn't even begin to, I guess, put myself in, you know, or try and articulate what they're trying to achieve. I guess what I would say to that is, I guess going back to where we started in relation to protest activity, of course, free speech and the lawful right to protest is something that we should protect in this country. But where someone's belief system or, you know, their ideology, their motivation drives them towards actual acts of criminality or acts of violence, where they're breaching our legislation, you know, that is where the AFP will take action. And I guess if I could say, you know, to individuals and groups out there who are looking to tear at our social fabric by, you know, causing hatred, causing fear within the community, and it is criminal, they are on notice. We will be taking action.
Will that include tougher penalties? Will you be seeking legislation that allows for tougher penalties?
So the government introduced new legislation this year in relation to what we describe as hate crimes. So we obviously will be utilising that legislation and, in fact, have a number of investigations underway in relation to those pieces of legislation. Of course, we continue to, you know, assess whether we have the legislation that we need. If I describe how these national security investigations teams are going to work, there will be a national strategy that the AFP will lead in conjunction with our state and territory partners, in conjunction with ASIO and other partners to ensure that, you know, we have a holistic strategy in how we are going to counter some of these groups and individuals. So part of that will be looking at policy and opportunities for new and or amended legislation. Part of it will be looking at a really deep intelligence package that can be provided to all of our law enforcement partners so that we have a consistent and deep understanding of where the threats are and where we need to target our efforts. And of course, you know, the other part of the strategy is the operational activities. So how are we actually deploying our capabilities in a very strategic way so that we can achieve the impact that we're looking to achieve, which obviously always comes back to protecting the community.
Have we seen an escalation in threats against federal parliamentarians? And if so, can you contextualise that? How many more threats are politicians getting?
Yes. So the National Security Investigations Team's actually part of their remit is investigating and prosecuting threats against federal parliamentarians. So we have, as the AFP, we have spoken a number of times publicly over the last few years around the increase in volume of threatening emails, threatening phone calls, threatening behaviour towards parliamentarians, offensive, abusive correspondence to parliamentarians. So that is very much a focus for us. Of course, in protecting the individual safety and security of parliamentarians, but just how inherent it is to protecting our democracy in this country. The federal election was an enormous undertaking for us in the AFP to ensure that not only could parliamentarians people, in the elections were feeling safe and secure enough to go about what they needed to as part of their election
campaign. Could you put a number on the threats?
We have got some figures that I can provide to you, but I can say over the last couple of years, those numbers have almost doubled in terms of the number of threats.
How much has the war in Gaza featured in the substance or the context of those threats?
I think going back to what I said earlier, it is well acknowledged that overseas events do reverberate here. And we know that we, have Australians who feel very passionately about events that are occurring overseas for a variety of reasons. We have heard the Director General of ASIO speak a number of times around words do matter and the impact that that can have on our social cohesion. So I think we do need to acknowledge that that has been one of the reasons why we have seen an increase in threats against federal parliamentarians. And it goes to my earlier description of the operating environment in general, I think, and how much we have seen a shift in the last couple of years, which again is why we're calling out, what the critical role that the AFP plays in relation to these threats.
To move on to another priority area, you mentioned young people. How large is the AFP's caseload when dealing with young people at risk of radicalisation?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's grown. We have seen our caseload grow over the last few years. It is not dissimilar to what our partners overseas are experiencing. So particularly our Five Eyes partners, we talk a lot through our Five Eyes network and work very jointly, I guess, in relation to common observations and common treatment options or strategies that we can put in place. What is also concerning, I think, is the age at which we're seeing some of these young people come onto our radar. So we have seen young people as well as young as 12 or 13 years of age, which is frightening for all of us.
How are they being targeted?
Yeah, so this goes to my priority around protecting vulnerable communities. I describe these young people as vulnerable young people. So often what we see is young people who, for a number of reasons, are either disenfranchised, disassociated from what we describe as normally the protective factors that sit around a young person. So their family, their school, their sporting clubs, general community factors that keep a child safe and provide that protection. So they're already sort of disenfranchised from those protective factors. We know young people are spending more and more time online, and what we are seeing is it doesn't take a long time at all for a young person to radicalise down a pathway towards violent extremism. So it may start out with curiosity. It may start out with a grievance that they're looking to act upon. And then we see people taking advantage of that. We see people taking advantage of young people who are susceptible to I guess what we describe as an echo chamber. They start hearing and seeing the same narrative, the same rhetoric through the online communications that they're having. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes quite difficult for them to, balance that with a broader narrative. So,
And is that predominantly, religious, ideological extremism, or is it also far right extremism?
It's everything. It's all of those. It's all of the above. In our general caseload across our what we describe as our terrorism caseload, we have seen more of a shift in ideologically driven motivations. So for a long time, it was the vast portion of our terrorism investigations were religiously motivated violent extremism. So around 80% of our caseload. We now see that caseload sitting at around 55% with ideologically driven motivations at around 35%. So that is a shift. What we are also seeing is a rising prevalence of what we describe as mixed or unclear ideology or motivation, where it is actually not one particular thing. It's a combination of things, and sometimes those things are actually in direct, contradiction to each other. But it's more about a young person looking to attach to a cause or something to further their violent extremist, how they want to express whatever their grievance might be.
So obviously, the murder of Charlie Kirk would be front of mind for a lot of people ideologically motivated. Is that the type of thing that, feasibly could occur in Australia?
I think it could occur in any country. I think, as I said, a lot of the engagement we have with partner countries, they are seeing very similar environments to what we are seeing here. Perhaps not, some of those countries are quite, at a higher scale than what we are. But that's the opportunity we have to see what's happening overseas and to understand, how that could play out here and what that might look like here in Australia. Again, heading back to, why the AFP, why we are really taking a lead role in social cohesion. Because we see, these groups are not, they're not committing terrorism offences, but that their behaviour has national security consequences, and it could lead and or inspire people to violent extremism. It could lead and or inspire people to terrorism. So, we really need to focus on that, of course, to protect the community, but also so that we ensure we are having a disrupting impact before we get to an incident such as the one you've just referred to.
Will social media bans for teenagers under 16 help?
So, I've already spoken about how prevalent it is that our young people are using social media and are using, the internet. It's so vast. It is a really vast space for us to be trying to police. Again, going back to why it's so important that we have those strong partnerships, that we can, have that layered effect where, we are using all of our own capabilities to have that force multiplier. And we have seen, examples in the AFP where partner agencies have shared information from things they've identified through their own online capabilities about activities that were happening in Australia, and we have taken action and disrupted. So yes, it is a huge problem for us. The social media bans, will obviously go away to helping put those guardrails around how young people use social media. But it will continue to be obviously an extremely high focus for us.
Just want to bring up the case of Thomas Carrick, a 13-year-old autistic boy who had a fixation on the Islamic State. A magistrate found that undercover AFP officers further radicalised him and fed his fixation on the Islamic State, after his parents went to police with concerns that he was becoming radicalised. Are you confident that the AFP has the appropriate methods when dealing with vulnerable young people?
I am confident. I see every day what our investigators are dealing with in terms of the caseload that they have in front of them. Having been the Deputy Commissioner for National Security prior to coming into the Commissioner role, I have a very deep understanding and awareness and oversight of our Counterterrorism and Special Investigations Command and the work that we do in that command, the way that we do that work. What I would say to you generally about young people and the risk that they pose, of course, our priority where we can is always looking at ways to disrupt and de-radicalise a young person and give them the best chance of, going on to have a prosperous life. But our investigators are balancing risk, heavy risk, every single day on behalf of this country. The risks are real. We have seen young people who do have the intent and they do have the capability to undertake acts of violent extremism, terrorism. We have seen multiple examples of young people who were quite a way down a path of mobilising to violence and had well-constructed plans to do that. So whilst, you know, of course, as a commissioner, as a police officer, as a parent, you know, my priorities around how do we protect young people, particularly those most vulnerable to being radicalised, we also have a very difficult job to do in managing the risk posed by some of these young people and protecting the community. And I would like to think that that is what the community expects of us as the National Law Enforcement Agency.
So what would your advice be to parents who are concerned that their teenagers, their children could be radicalised?
I think the messages are very clear. Parents need to know what their children are doing online. They need to know who their children are engaging with online. They need to use the appropriate online security settings to protect their children. You know, your children are so, I've said it multiple times, they're so vulnerable. They almost, you know, to the point of naivety in terms of the people that exist that are out there, and the harm that those people are looking to do to our young people, the way they're looking to use our young people as vehicles to undertake particular acts or have a particular effect. We can't expect our young people to have the maturity to, you know, to know and identify when some of that behaviour is occurring. That's why, you know, as parents, we need to know, as I said, what our kids are doing online, who are they engaging with, and be suspicious, be sceptical about the games your kids are playing online. You know, we have seen multiple examples of mainstream gaming platforms being used to radicalise young kids. And again, as I said, it can happen quite quickly.
But can parents be confident that if they go to police, their children won't be further radicalised?
Yeah. The strong message is have an understanding of what your child is doing. If there are changes in behaviour in your child or you have concerns, then you should reach out to us early, work with us in terms of, as I said, our priority will always be to protect that child and to, you know, that there are a range of programs that exist across the Commonwealth and in the states and territories to wrap around a young person who may be in that, you know, that type of scenario. So, you know, we need to identify it early. We need to take action early before it gets to a point where we're so far down a pathway that the risks are so real that, you know, that some of those avenues are not available to us anymore.
Just another point on vulnerable communities. SBS has done many stories about human trafficking, whether it be forced marriage or exit trafficking. Who is most at risk of forced marriage in this country?
So if I take you back to my five priorities, one of the priorities being protective vulnerable communities, that is another cohort that we describe as vulnerable communities. And again, taking you back to how important it is that we have the strong partnerships, both domestically around government and, you know, non-government organisations and the role that they play with us in partnership. But of course, you know, overseas as well, having those strong relationships with law enforcement agencies overseas so that we can take quick action to protect people being susceptible and or people who are have been human trafficked. We have had a lot of success in terms of investigating, disrupting and prosecuting human trafficking offending incredibly vulnerable community that we need to be protecting.
What are the role that schools can play?
Schools can play a big role, not just, so if I'm talking about protecting vulnerable communities more broadly, not just specific to human trafficking, but some of the other things I've been talking about around youth radicalisation, talking around, child exploitation and children at risk. Often it's schools that are seeing the changes in behaviour, if not as much, even more so than what a family unit might see. So our schools play an incredibly protective factor for our young people. I think the expectation of the Australian community is that across sectors, we are all working together to ensure that we're keeping our young people safe. We all have a role to play. We all have, levers that we can pull. We all have early warning signs that we can pick up and identify, these risks very early so that we can take constructive action that then allows a young person to, have a safe and prosperous life.
Look, after the apparent communication issues between agencies after the Dural caravan explosive hoax, the government decided to reunite AFP and ASIO under the Home Affairs Ministry. Do you welcome that move?
What I would say to that is, I mean, we work fantastic with ASIO every single day across, multiple areas of our, multiple common areas of remit. And we have joint teams that ASIO and AFP are part of that have been extremely successful. So I think what I would say to that is, regardless of where we would sit structurally within government, the relationship is so close, that the partnership is so close that,
doesn't matter.
It really, of course, it brings some benefits, but we were already working very closely with ASIO.
Because it seemed the Prime Minister was kept in the dark. Were the agencies limited in their interactions?
So I'll talk about the joint counterterrorism teams there, which it was the New South Wales joint counterterrorism team that investigated the Dural caravan matter, Operation Kissinger. Those teams have been working together. We've been hugely successful in our joint counterterrorism teams for over 20 years now, and particularly if you think about the New South Wales joint counterterrorism team, some of the really significant terrorism disruptions that we've had, significant terrorism investigations we've had in New South Wales. The relationships in relation to that joint team are very deep and very mature and very sophisticated. The systems and the machinery that sits around the joint counterterrorism teams is very mature, and it's tried and tested and it works. I would say that, policing is a complex business. We have investigators and we have police officers that are very passionate about what they do. Part of working in a joint team, you are not always going to agree on a pathway or agree on a decision. I expect that is robust partnerships where you've got the trust and you've got the systems to allow those robust discussions to occur. What I can say without hesitation and with full confidence is that all partner agencies in the joint counterterrorism teams have Australia's safety as their utmost primary mission and focus.
Commissioner Barrett, thank you for speaking with SBS.
Thank you.